Geopolitics and Empire is joined by Dr. Adam Stuhlberg, who is Sam Nunn Professor and Chair in the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs. He teaches international security, Russia, Eurasian politics and security affairs, nuclear nonproliferation, and energy security, among many other topics. He's served as a political consultant at RAND, has worked closely with former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn in drafting policy recommendations, has authored five books, and received numerous accolades. Welcome to Geopolitics and Empire, Dr. Stuhlberg.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It just so happens, I didn't realize this, but we're recording on the first year anniversary of the Ukraine war. And so there's a lot going on. And maybe just to start, to get your, big picture, broad take on the situation. You've been looking at Ukraine and Russia in different respects for many years, I guess more on the nuclear non-proliferation energy sectors and elsewhere. But after it's been 1 year, what are sort of your thoughts as to what's going on and how things are going?
Well, when I reflect back, on the year, I think the word that comes to mind is surprise. I think this is we're in a situation where no one thought we would be. In other words, in a war of attrition, 1 year out, everybody was expecting. Well, first, it wasn't clear if anybody was expecting war to break out in early 2022, although the intelligence agencies at the months before or a month before began to pull the fire alarm on that. But the for the most part, I think everybody was caught by surprise. Then when Putin launched the initial military campaign and the failure to capture Kyiv in a sort of a lightning kind of strike. That the Russians tried that type of maneuver. That was not what people were expecting. They were expecting to see more of a classic, tank armored campaign go rapidly, a blitzkrieg kind of across Ukraine. But that was not what was attempted. So that caught people by surprise. The failure of that effort and the logistical problems that were exposed and the military incompetence that was exposed by the Russian military, I think that was caught everybody by surprise. The resilience of Ukrainians, both the leadership and the population, to stand firm. If people remember, Zelensky was not regarded as a very strong leader. That at the time did not have a lot of political legitimacy, or I should say authority. He certainly wasn't seen as a war leader. And yet he has surprised everybody by his ability to really rally the country and remain, invigorated, popular and effective politician and leader for the country. I think everybody was surprised at how resilient NATO and Europe has been in standing firm. And now we have Sweden and Finland reversing decades of their policy position explicitly to become members of NATO. So that's caught everybody. I think another thing that's caught everybody by surprise is the United States, notwithstanding the war, made it very clear at the onset that we were going to avoid direct conflict. This was not news to Ukrainians or to the Putin leadership. Yet we saw nuclear weapons being brandished, albeit in an opaque manner, almost from the get-go of the war. So here's a war where the United States clearly put limits on our level of military engagement. From the onset, yet all of a sudden, on numerous occasions, we've seen the Putin regime practice nuclear brinksmanship, seemingly out of nowhere. And of course, another surprise has been we were debating whether or not we should provide Javelin, anti-tank weaponry. And now we are not only providing that weaponry in long-term and long-range artillery, but we are providing tanks. And now there's even some deliberation about attack aircraft. So we are in a very different place 1 year later than we thought we'd be. And as our thinking was evolving over the course of the year, we still have been caught by surprises, as I've mentioned. So surprise, I think, is the watchword for the year, not to mention disaster, tragedy at all levels, of course, that and the endurance that the Ukrainians have demonstrated and had to experience, but surprise at the high level globally, I think, is a big issue. And also, I would say surprise on the energy front too. I mean, everybody thought that energy was going to be the cudgel, and that was going to be the weak link in the chain, if you will, among the Western allies. And the European allies not only are willing to stand firm in their military assistance, but to stand firm in the face of high gas prices and challenges. Because if you remember, going into 2022, European gas stocks, storage facilities were not in a good place. And so there was an expectation that this was going to be a lever that Russia could use and continue to use. But we've seen that is not the case as well.
A quick shout out to our sponsors, which you can locate via the sponsor page on geopoliticsandempire.com, or whose links are included in every podcast description. I've tried privacy phones in the past, such as Silent Circle's Black Phone, which turned out to be a dud. The best and really only option so far is de-Googling your phone. Now, you can do it yourself, but I've never had the time to figure that out and simply got an Above phone. They sell de-Googled phones that come with a suite of software. They also provide support and a monthly Above privacy suite with many features such as a unique phone number, encryption, email, VPN, and so forth. If you're looking for a private phone, check out Above phone. Make sure to click on the Above phone link on geopoliticsandempire.com or via the podcast description so that we can enjoy a commission. Also, check out the Nomos Time Bank at nomos.net, which you can download in Spanish or English to your Apple or Google or de-Googled phone. Nomos allows people in your community to exchange services using time as a currency rather than fiat money. This will be one great way to survive in the coming algorithm ghetto. If you need health insurance, you can talk to my friend James Guzman of the Borderless Blog Podcast and Health Insurance. He offers free consultations. Simply schedule a time with him over at borderlesshealthinsurance.com. Finally, you can donate directly to Geopolitics and Empire, consult with me, the host, or become a member to join private monthly member Zoom calls where we shoot the breeze discussing world events.
I did want to get your thoughts on energy, and I would say you've given a fair assessment. I know some people might get angry. I try to stay in the middle because, you know, with the Western narrative and the Russian narrative, especially on the telegrams, I feel they both go to extremes. But there's a few people that I've been interviewing that are Slavs, you know, Serbians, as well as Russians, who are saying, well, Russia isn't, really, and as you said, they're making errors and they're not doing so well militarily. And so Russian red lines, something you've been talking about. And I had a recent guest, Brussels-based analyst Gilbert Doctorow, where he was talking about red lines and how both Russia and the West are testing each other's red lines. And you mentioned direct conflict. I recently saw a clip from earlier in the month. An Austrian colonel was saying how the way with which they would avoid direct conflict, they were going to have NATO soldiers or Austrian soldiers or Polish soldiers take off their uniforms, he was basically saying, and work as mercenaries or private contractors in Ukraine. So that way, technically, there wouldn't be direct conflict between Russia. But this sort of talk is also kind of crazy, as you said. And I have heard some commentary from Western generals or leaders urging us to start direct war or conflict with Russia. And as you say, on both sides, there's talk about tactical mini nukes and this sort of stuff. So, you know, any further thoughts that you have on the red lines and escalation from here on out? Because it does seem we are on this slow trajectory of, you know, step-by-step escalation, and it's not looking good.
So a couple of things. One is, I'm not a military analyst, so operationally I'm out of my depths. But I would say that from my vantage point, and especially at the strategic level, I do think Russia, they made all of those mistakes that I mentioned on the ground and operationally and logistically, but they are learning. And the Russia military prowess today is not where they were in March of 2022. So there's learning going on, and the type of warfare, this attrition warfare and mounting some sort of offensive that we seem to be on the precipice of, if not already engaged in, is something that is different than we saw in the past. So I would be careful about drawing too many inferences about an incompetent Russian military. I think there are a lot of advantages that they have militarily on the conventional level to wage this kind of war. And I do think at the strategic level that the Kremlin still thinks that time is on its side, as opposed to the need to gamble for resurrection, which we'll talk about in a minute. But you also mentioned mercenaries, and that's another dimension that's kind of a little bit beyond my pale, but it also gets to some of the surprises, which is the dissension, the open dissension between the Wagner Group leadership and the high command in the Russian military, which is especially in the recent days, has really come out into the open, where Prigozhin seems to be really, castigating the high command for not providing enough supplies and maybe even intentionally withholding supplies. And there's been a longstanding tension between Wagner Group and the Russian military. But I would also note that Wagner is not the only mercenary group involved. Obviously, the Kadyrovsky, the Kadyrov's groups, there's some other groups, Cossacks. So this is a surprising dimension as well. The emergence of multiple mercenary groups in Russia, and the relationship between the Kremlin, the high command, and these groups is not all that clear. And in the event that we do see in the future, which we don't see now, domestic instability in Russia, this could be be quite foreboding. But so those are two elements: the conventional capability and the mercenary dimension to it. But you really asked me about the red line issue, and this is actually quite interesting because there's been a lot of discussion about red lines, and there's, on the one hand, people think that these explicit statements of, lines in the sand, drawing lines in the sand, or explicit threats with consequences issued by Putin, which have been, which spiked in 2021 and 2022. By the way, red lines are not a traditional Russian way of practicing crisis diplomacy, but we have seen a spike. In fact, some of my own research, we've recorded the Russian president uttering the explicit red line terms about 54 times since 2000. But about over 50% of those times have been in 2021 and 2022 and the beginning of 2023. So they have resorted to that term. But what's and so for many, that resort is either a sign of some sort of strategic signaling that that the Kremlin is trying to convey. Others see this as really a last-ditch effort by a leader that's playing a weak hand, if not an irrational leader or a ruthless leader. But nonetheless, increasingly, there's the view in the West that the seemingly inability to back up the red line threat suggests that these threats may be hollow, and that increasingly there are signs of bluster, not resolve. And as a result, there's a tendency to discount the statements about red lines. So red lines have garnered a lot of attention. From my own research, like I mentioned, they are not used frequently by Russian presidents, as opposed to we think about those as a mainstay almost for deterrence, right? In the Western canon, a red line is all about making explicit your deterrent threat, right? So they have to involve a threat with a consequence, and they're made explicitly as a way to reduce or to bolster the credibility of your deterrent threat by increasing the reputational cost, both domestically and internationally, of reneging on those red lines, right? So it's all about deterrence, and it's a way of demonstrating credibility, because you're going to go say something explicitly, don't do this or else, And that puts political pressure by your, you know, by the international community and the domestic arena. Well, for that to be the case, they have to be very explicit by definition. Well, when we look more carefully at these 54 times that they've been used by the Russian president, we see, one, they're anything but clear. They're opaque. Rarely, there are multiple threats. Don't send troops into Ukraine. Don't provide offensive weapons. Don't provide defensive weapons. Don't provide long-range artillery. Right. Don't move. Don't have NATO troops stationed near the border of Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So there have been multiple red lines. Right. But these threats have not been backed by explicit consequences. Right. So rarely does the Russian president ever say what the consequence would be of transgressing that red line. There has not been one paragraph in a speech by a Russian by Putin. In 2021 or 2022 or 2023, where red lines, explicit reference to red lines and nuclear in any context have been made. Yes, there have been opaque references to nuclear weapons. And yes, there have been explicit statements about red lines, but not that the two have not been related together. Notwithstanding the debate in the West about if we cross one of these red lines, we're risking nuclear escalation. So very interesting dynamic there. And my own research suggests that one of the reasons we're seeing this, it's not that Putin is irrational, not that he's necessarily these are necessarily hollow threats. It's that they have a different approach to competitive bargaining. And their concept of deterrence is aimed at blurring lines between peace and war, enhancing uncertainty, not reducing uncertainty like bolstering credibility that we think about. It's to cause confusion, to manipulate the adversary's understanding of its environment, to complicate an adversary's decision-making, to fumble on its own internal debates, to draw conclusions about what Russia is doing or not doing, to then ultimately be self-deterred. So it's a fundamentally different approach to crisis bargaining. Now, from my vantage point, this is doubly dangerous. It's dangerous because it's opaque and not linear. By the way, you were suggesting that there's a sense that we're gradually ratcheting up pressure, but the way they use red lines, like I said, they issued red lines at the very beginning of the conflict, before there was a war of attrition or there was really any signs of their fumbling on their own demise. So they've been issued sporadically during this period. And I would argue that it's not part of a linear turning of the screws. It's all about creating confusion at different moments. And but this is a problem because on the one hand, you're doing the exact opposite of what we think a red line is. You're creating uncertainty, which can lead to misperceptions and miscalculations on our part. And by the way, those miscalculations might not lead us to be paralyzed like the Russian strategy may be aimed at, but actually increase our resolve to stand firm and keep pressing ahead. And that's the other problem, is that the repeated experience that we have by not seeing a Russian leader stand firm in these red lines increases our perception that these are hollow threats. And if they're not hollow threats, but we're playing different, we have different playbooks for competitive and crisis bargaining, then it's like we're walking in each other's minefield. There may be a risk of escalation, but it will be punctuated, not gradual. And that's the challenge, I think. That's the doubly dangerous part of it, is that it really risks taking us both to outcomes like an escalation to an unconventional use of weaponry that neither or none of the sides want at this stage. Now, I would say that's today. And I still, my reading of the Kremlin is that they still think time is on their side. They think that they're, you know, Ukraine's fighting a classic, you know, war, conventional war, and you know, Russia's not really paying any cost at home, so they can regenerate their capabilities, albeit maybe with not the most sophisticated weaponry, but the kind of war that they're waging doesn't require necessarily you know, huge inventories of highly accurate surgical strike kinds of capabilities. They can throw both people and older capabilities, dumber capabilities at targets to outlast Ukraine. So I think that they feel, as long as they can maintain the messaging at home, as well as the political control at home, that they are, time is on their side, and it's only a matter of time before the stockpiles begin to get depleted in the West, the wariness of the war begins to take place among different domestic, in different domestic political contexts in Europe and in the United States, and that the divisions between what our aims may be to ending this conflict and Ukrainian aims may be very different. And so I still think, as long as they're optimistic, then their calculation is about the willingness to pay costs to achieve their benefits. But should they switch and feel like it's all about minimizing damage and preventing a certain loss to the regime or otherwise, then I think the calculation begins to change. And that's where I think we have an opportunistic Putin change and become a more risky Putin or Russian leadership. And that's where I think it gets to the triple danger that I was mentioning, because then those red line statements could all of a sudden switch, and then there'd be more of a willingness to take a risk, to gamble on resurrection. So it's going to be this is the challenge for us, because as long as a war is being waged, we want to make sure that the Russians are paying a high cost. But in the event that the Russians feel that defeat, and especially the Kremlin feels that defeat is imminent, and it may have domestic political reverberations for them, that's when things may get more unpredictable, and you may see a more risk-prone Kremlin. But I don't think we're there yet. But this is one of the challenges moving forward to the next year, is how to manage that balance between, you know, as long as they continue to fight and not be willing to engage in some sort of, you know, peace talks. And it's not only, obviously, Russia's got to be getting to that point, and they have not been willing to do that up to now. But Ukraine also needs to do that. And to be in a position to do that before that can happen. But until we're in that situation, we need to be careful about, you know, these notions of total victory, because that could have that could shift their calculus to increasing risk taking.
Yeah, I'm reminded of my interview back in 2021 before the war began with former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, who even back then was talking about us being in the nuclear specter, and just as you're sort of outlining that that exists most definitely, and just about those hollow red lines. Again, some of the Slavs that I've talked to, who are by no means anti-Russian themselves, but they are kind of seeing, they're pointing out the incompetence of Russia, and so how some of these threats may be hollow. Not that they're wanting that to be the case, but they're trying to be more realistic versus some of these people who are hyping up, Russia. And I'm trying to see things as they are, and that's why I get poo-pooed on from everyone from all sides. But talking about then, I guess, the economic front, sanctions, all these Western sanctions on Russia. I mean, I've even had Russian listeners who would donate to the podcast send me a mail like a year ago saying, sorry, I can't donate anymore because I'm cut off from SWIFT. But it seems that up until now, Russia has been batting down the hatches and doing well economically. And just to one of your previous points, I think that's the strategy Russia has historically of you know, taking it on the chin. Like if we look at, you know, when Napoleon invaded Russia and they pulled back and, you know, for many months that they used this sort of strategy, this long game, and that served them well. And, you know, when Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, that also worked well for them. So I think they're used to that. But there's all this talk now of BRICS, BRICS Plus. Just yesterday, I was reading Belarus is interested in joining BRICS. So I guess it would be two B's in BRICS, BRICS Plus, and then there's this talk of multipolar world. And then the East, if Russia's cut off from sanctions, they're like, okay, we're just going to direct our gas exports to, you know, China and India, and building pipelines through Mongolia and so on and so forth. And so what's your take on the sanctions as well as this, you know, multipolar world that's all the rage now?
Right. So I would say a couple of things. One, you know, to go back to sanctions and my original point about surprises, one of the things that's been very surprising has been the magnitude or scope of the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia in terms of the economic impact that they've had. But that said, there's a difference between economic impact and success of sanctions, right? So sanctions are not just imposed to level pain on an adversary. They're designed to advance some sort of objective, like stopping the war, pull out of Crimea, pull out of the Donetsk and Luhansk. I mean, they're specific objectives, and those objectives clearly haven't been realized. And if anything, we're seeing the a willingness by the Kremlin to double down on the military dimension to the war, notwithstanding the costs that they're incurring at all levels, economic costs, political costs, military costs, international reputational costs. So sanctions to date, it's hard to point to them as having strategic success, right? They've had and there's some debate over the economic impact that they've had. I mean, IMF has readjusted their projections. I mean, they had between 2% and 4%, reduction in GDP last year, and then they're, you know, around 2% or 3% projected for 2023. But these are not the level of magnitude that people were talking about. Inflation maybe on the, you know, maybe growing, but it's spiking as was projected. And so obviously Russia economically is speaking, and there are a number of reasons. They're the fortress, going from the fortress Russia's strategy to the oil prices, the gradual dimension to the nature of sanctions, and the limited element of sanctions that have really, for the most part, been targeted. They've just increased the targets, but they haven't made them massive sanctions. So there are a number of reasons on the tactical side. But I would say the biggest thing to keep in mind about Russia as a target for economic warfare and economic sanctions is we needed to appreciate what the purpose has been. The purpose has shifted. So prior to 2022, the goal was really to deter Russia from further escalation, as well as to get them to reverse their policies in Crimea, et cetera. After 2022, the focus is, increasingly gravitated towards degradation of Russia's military capability and industrial capability. Well, those are two rather large burdens to level on, to heap on sanctions as an instrument of policy. Because Russia has a number of different release valves for that. First off, they can respond to sanctions as they have in different ways. They don't just respond by reciprocal sanctions of leveling, like, you know, their own agricultural sanctions. They can block some of the sanctions. They can, through import substitution, they can look for other markets, like you mentioned with oil and gas, with, China and India, to some extent. They can have macroeconomic policies that can impose macroeconomic controls, which they've actually proved quite deft at doing. They can also lash out in other ways, not just on an economic plane, but one of the things we were seeing in the lead up to the war is that as we were leveling more and more sanctions, they were practicing other coercive behavior, either by pulling out of or threatening to pull out of the cooperation in the talks with Iran, you know, increasing their escalating their military involvement in Syria, obviously escalating their malign activities in Ukraine. So there were a lot of other dimensions to their coercive behavior that were not being captured by just focusing on economic statecraft. But the other thing to keep in mind about Russia is that there are two kinds of shock absorbers that they have. One is their whole understanding of sanctions and the relationship between sanctions and war is different than ours. For the most part, we have historically seen sanctions as an alternative to kinetic military conflict. And, you know, in a nutshell, they've increasingly grouped sanctions with information warfare and energy diplomacy as part of a broader definition of war, this new next generation warfare, which blurs, again, the line between peace and warfare. And as a result, any signals that we were trying to send with sanctions prior to 2022 were kind of getting lost in the way that they were thinking they were already at war. So these were not, you know, the kinds of things that we were trying to deter, I think, were not resonating. And if anything, the fact that we were so targeted with our sanctions was possibly sending a signal of our weak resolve and that they didn't think we were willing to stand up any firmer than targeted sanctions, or we didn't have the political capacity to sustain anything more than those targeted sanctions. Now, I think both sides were proved wrong with the you know, current rounds of sanctions just, you know, continuing to escalate. But that said, they have a different playbook of war. But also, there's some cushions in terms of the Kremlin. The way that, you know, in a nutshell, you know, the political economy of the Kremlin is such that, you know, Putin really allocates rents across different stakeholders among the elite. And as a result, sanctions that target oligarchs, first off, there are oligarchs that are highly leveraged in the West that have no influence over the Kremlin. They're just vulnerable. And you've seen their yachts and other things get easily taken up. The ones that actually are closer to the Kremlin, well, the sanctions only drive them even closer to the Kremlin, right? Because they're losing any other opportunities. The other people around Putin, security forces and close cronies from St. Petersburg and other Siloviki, well, they have no constituency other than they're bound up with Putin. So targeting sanctions on the Russian elite doesn't lead to, you know, an opportunity to drive a wedge between them and Putin. It just drives them more to Putin. Now, with the population, you know, this is something that I think neither we nor, frankly, the Kremlin have a very clear understanding. But to date, we've seen that recessions and, you know, GDP volatility has not led to demonstrations in the streets. And historically, the Putin regime has relied on providing stable employment, providing pensions, providing energy subsidies. These are the basic deals that they make with the population. It's not about efficiency. It's not about, innovation. It's these basics. And to the extent that the Russian economy has continued to be able to provide those things, that provides a lot of insulation. And hence you see a depolitization, if you will, overtly at least, of the Russian population. You know, and this is reflected. Now, you can only take polls in Russia with, you have to look at them for what they are. But nonetheless, they've been recording a pretty stable Russian popular position on sanctions, which are one, they, you know, don't see them as having tremendous impact on them. But they do see that they're here for a while. So they've kind of reconciled themselves to that. So sanctions' ability to actually change Russia's strategic behavior has to be mediated through something, either through the elites or through the masses. And we see these kinds of the perverse political nature of the regime provides some shock absorbers for that. And, you know, so therefore, there are some Russian economists and other economists who say that, well, even at Russian oil prices at $50 a barrel, even with price caps, this is sustainable over a number of years. Now, I would argue that this may be the basic deal, but sanctions alone are not going to move the needle on this. But sanctions in combination with an awareness among people about the war and about the bloodshed in the war, and i.e. the casualties or body bags that may be brought back, that may begin to precipitate some agitation. But to date, we haven't seen that. And I don't think anybody, including the Kremlin, has a real good handle on when something could all of a sudden punctuate and escalate and then spiral out of control. And that, again, takes us back to what I was saying before. When the Kremlin doesn't feel confident about knowing that calculus, or they begin to see a convergence of different things, from the economic impact of sanctions to the bloodiness of the war to more publicity about the casualties or just demonstrations that, you know, because in Russia there are actually legal demonstrations protesting utility price hikes, right? So there are constantly demonstrations going on. They're just not tied to the war or to a reaction to the sanctions, but they could be indirectly affecting, you know, the sanctions and the war could be indirectly affecting some of those. And depending on how governors or mayors or potentially the federal government in Russia responds to some of these things, that could be a tripwire. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that are unpredictable, I think, there based on this regime. So they are, I think, more stable, and they have shock absorbers for sort of traditional types of sanctions approaches by themselves, especially targeted sanctions. But there's some unpredictability about these things. So, and the regime doesn't have a, you know, we saw this with the Kursk incident years ago, when the regime just gave bold-faced lies to the Russian population. And it was the mothers of the soldiers that were castigating Putin that led to a spiral of demonstrations across the country. And this is a time where Putin had very high approval ratings. They weren't at war. They weren't sort of ostracized from the international community. And yet, all of a sudden, you had this punctuated instability. Well, I think that is a very telling moment, not so much because, any kind of single predictable incident is it could precipitate this kind of instability, but it's the sheer unknown and unpredictable nature of that that makes it very complicated. And it really works against sanctions. It's really hard to measure then the effectiveness of these sanctions and realizing it. So, and some people think, well, just put more pain and more impact, and at some point it'll facilitate some of these things. Well, maybe. On the other hand, we may be implicated in the sanctions. And that may lead to this rally around the flag kinds of things. It gives more resilience to the leadership. So it's a tightrope that we have to walk with sanctions. But the other thing that I would say about sanctions, which I think is the longer term issue or the medium term issue, is that once we get to a situation where the combatants, Russia and Ukraine, are at a point where they want to begin thinking about some kind of ceasefire and resolution, how are the sanctions going to be rolled back? And how are we going to roll them back in a way that's going to, in a calibrated way, to create incentives for a reformed Russian leadership and one that's committed to peaceful resolution tailored accordingly? And I think the more we heap these different rounds of sanctions on Russia, it's increasingly hard for seeing any Russian leadership seeing daylight at the end of anything. And that's going to be a challenge once we get to that. Right now, we're clearly not there. But if once we begin to shift and there becomes an opportunity to think about ceasefire and beyond, well, then we really need to think about how are we going to roll off these sanctions? What are the off ramps to the sanctions going to be? There have been very few studies on the efficacy of off ramps and the conditions under which and the modalities of an off ramp that could be effective and tying to some sort of longer term architecture for European stability. So be careful what you wish for in terms of sanctions, because they are having impact, but that impact isn't having the desired shift in Russian strategic behavior. And if that calculus begins to change in Russia, either one way or the other, they want to become more constructive well, then we've got a real challenge in figuring out how to roll back these sanctions. But if they become more worried and they don't have any glimmer of hope in the future, they begin to be prone to gamble for resurrection, though those sanctions are only convincing them that there's no future other than to take a risk. And that's, again, where I said before, we're in a danger zone. So be careful about these. Also, sanctions, there are a lot of other types of economic behavior that have surrounded the sanctions, like over 1,000 companies independently making decisions in the West to pull out of Russia. Well, it's not clear when it's time to re-engage Russia in the future with under a new leadership or whatever that context may be, that companies are going to want to come back. And so we could have the problem that we had, that we have even seen with Iran. Like when we have reached the JCPOA, a lot of companies are like a little bit leery because they're not sure whether or not the United States would honor that deal. The Trump administration reneged on that deal. And so these companies went back and then they were now going to be in the crosshairs of U.S. sanctions again when U.S. policy changed. Well, in this case, how can they trust the Russian government not to pull a stunt like it did with the war and leave them, hanging? So I think there are a lot of uncertainties about economic warfare and particularly sanctions as we look out over the horizon of this problem.
I did want to get your thought as well on the energy aspect and in the context of everything that we've talked about, because you've looked at oil, gas, the geopolitics of that. And I'm noticing a trend that in the Western world, like Western Europe and the Anglosphere, because of the new green deals that the EU is passing in the US, that we're moving away from hydrocarbons. But the rest of the world, I mean, especially here where I am in Mexico, we're still strong on gasoline. We've rejected, AMLO has rejected the renewables. I mean, they are installing wind and solar, but what do you see anything else for us that's important or relevant when it comes to oil, gas, and new pipelines that are being built between Eurasia? Is that going to make them stronger? Is there going to be any game changer there? Just any key point that you have when it comes to oil, gas, and energy?
Well, it's a very complicated story, obviously. I would say everybody was focused on pipelines, Nord Stream 2, et cetera, in the lead up to this war. But I think really, and I wrote about it before, and that going into, from 2021 going into 2022, the real problem was not pipelines. It was about gas storage. And that's where the Europeans were seen to be very vulnerable. And I think that's why that may have fed into the Russian calculus about when and why, the timing of the war and the nature of, thinking that the Europeans were going to fold earlier. But so one thing that's happened is the natural gas landscape has changed. We're not in the world of 2009 when there was a cutoff. Even 2014, we've seen a lot of difference. LNG and unconventionals have fundamentally changed the global landscape. And so that's created opportunities for gas to be delivered to Europe in different ways, albeit at a cost. But it does provide alternatives. And so, I have been arguing that since 2009, Russia has really watched energy become less and less a potent instrument of political and strategic influence. Sure, they sold a lot of gas and there's some economic costs that countries have been going to be paying, but the strategic leverage of gas, I think, was really waning and was due to wane significantly prior to this war, just because of the energy transition, climate change issues, et cetera, and the climate and energy transition policies, in particular by the EU. Also, I think China, of course, there have been new pipelines open to China, but the timeline for China's calculation and the prices that China has been able to wrangle, are not the same as what Russia has been thinking about. So, and India, yes, they bought some of the, the oil, during the war, but they have a limit as to how much they can purchase. So Europe at the end of the day is a huge established market for Russian energy. There's no substitute for it. In a time frame that is, that can affect this strategic kinds of calculus. And I would argue that China has historically hedged its bets. And I mean, it has deals in across Central Asia for pipelines. And of course, it buys most of its natural gas, imports most of its natural gas through LNG. And so they have much more flexibility on that. So I don't think they're tied to Russia's strategic designs. That said, they will certainly buy at a discount. So the price caps that have been imposed, both for crude and for the refined products, are, you know, play to their advantage to some extent. It gives them, you know, so that was one of the ingenious elements, at least of the crude price caps, is that China didn't have to sign on to it, but they would benefit by buying it even cheaper. So I think energy is becoming less and less of a strategic dimension. Now, one of the things for Europe that's fascinating, I think, is that a lot of people thought at the beginning of this war that Europe was going to be facing a very difficult choice between realizing their energy transition goals, you know, moving away from hydrocarbons, to then, you know, finding short-term stopgaps of natural gas, investing more in their interconnectors, and the ability to receive natural gas from alternative sources, which was going to come at an opportunity cost for advancing the energy transition and the decarbonization. But one of the things that I think is really interesting is the rise in discussion, especially in Europe, of hydrogen and potential for renewable hydrocarbons, which is sort of and those renewable hydrocarbons can be like taking carbon out of the atmosphere, not only converting it into a liquid, but utilizing it and utilizing your existing hydrocarbon infrastructure. So by thinking about hydrogen and thinking about renewable hydrocarbons, you can leverage your investments today in the pipelines and in the storage facilities of hydrocarbons for tomorrow's renewable hydrocarbons. So there doesn't have to be a zero-sum trade-off between investing in hydrocarbons and climate change issues. I should say carbon capture and utilization and hydrogen and advancing the energy transition. Now, one of the problems, though, is that Russia is increasingly getting divorced from these developments, right? And so, again, right now, it would be anathema to think about, you know, doing more energy deals with Russia. But in the future, when there's a different regime, because we have to think, do we want a huge vacuum of power in Eurasia? If there's any hope of engaging Russia, a reformed Russian leadership, a reformed Russia in the future, without hydrocarbons or without an energy dimension, that's going to be a big challenge for Russia. And so, you know, what are the ways that it could be plugged into? It has more promise in plugging into a renewable hydrocarbon footprint than just a strict non-hydrocarbon renewable footprint, which would then force them to make some choices that could be adverse to the climate interests of the globe. And so that's going to be a big challenge, I think, moving forward. So long story short, energy, I think, is becoming less of a strategic factor. Yes, it matters to us in the war right now because the rents from oil exports are used to support the military effort. So that's why the price caps are there, to try to get at those rents. But beyond that, energy as an instrument of creating asymmetrical dependence that then can be leveraged for strategic effects, I think that we're moving beyond that relatively rapidly.
So we've covered red lines, sanctions, energy. Is there any other important element or message you want to get across related to all of this?
Well, there are two probably things that I would mention that are more contemporary right now, in the sense that while we've seen Russia declare that it's unilaterally suspending its participation in the START treaty, which is the last significant arms control agreement. And, you know, some people say, well, it's not a big deal. They were already suspending their inspectors. But arms control is only important, is especially important when we have acrimonious relationships, because it's one of the only sources for transparency. And right now, maybe this is part of that political manipulation that I was talking about, where Russia has been very careful about their withdrawal. They've said they're suspending their participation, but that decision is reversible. So they're leaving the door open. Another thing that they've said is that, you know, they said, well, if the U.S. tests, we're going to test, but we have no plans to test. So that's kind of more of a red herring that they're throwing in there. But the risk is they're denigrating arms control further. And as a result, that could make the future of arms control, especially for domestic political, support, much more challenging. And again, at the end of the day, arms control is not, we're not doing a favor for any side. Arms control is about introducing transparency, especially among rivals, and on issues that could be existential for both or for all sides. And as a result, arms control is an important part of deterrence or even a competitive strategy. It is not a substitute for strategic interaction or based on solely on trust. It plays an important strategic role. And the more we denigrate that, especially as our relationship becomes more hostile with Russia, the more peril we're putting ourselves in. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing is, don't forget about domestic politics over the next year. You're going to have domestic politics in Ukraine, domestic politics in Russia, and we're going to start getting caught up in our domestic politics. And right now, the domestic politics is not conducive for any one side to begin to, you know, convey a willingness for constructive engagement. And as they get closer to those elections, there's going to be more domestic pressure on Putin to demonstrate his legitimacy by standing firm, because he's got to demonstrate that he's got more than 70% approval, because he's got to be better than before. And so, and of course, Zelensky is going to have an increasingly narrow area for him to make any kind of concessions. And then we too, Biden is invested heavily in the war and demonstrating our leadership. And so if the parties aren't willing to reach agreement, then it's going to be a challenge for us. And so, and not to mention managing Republican defection or any other questions among the American public about the sustainability of our commitment. So domestic politics, I think, is going to be playing a bigger role over the next year than it did during the first year.
Yeah, you know, 2023, 2024 are going to be interesting, but it's just like every year is just crazy things are happening. So every year is just nuts. There are so many interesting, crazy, important things, scary things are going on. And we've sort of covered the waterfront. If you've got any final thought, and then where would be the best places to find you online, or any specific projects that you have that we should know about?
Well, the best place to find me is on my school website. I'm the Sam Nunn Professor and Chair of the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs at Georgia Tech. And so you can see what we're up to. We'll actually be having next week a symposium on the war and sort of reflections about the war from, you know, not only a military perspective, but this broader geoeconomic and geostrategic perspective. So I invite any and all to join us, and you can find out more about that on our website. And my research is posted there as well. So I would look forward to engaging with folks in that way, or with your audience directly again with you.
All right. I will include all of those links to your work and the Sam Nunn School in the description. So everyone be sure to follow Dr. Stuhlberg there. And thank you for being on Geopolitics and Empire.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned geopolitics and empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our pro account. The best free way to help geopolitics and empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.